Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Chances are, if you like this podcast, you'll like other podcasts made by Lush. So why not listen to the Lush podcast? It's a podcast. It's made by Lush, hence the name. Find it where you find podcasts, usually on the internet.
Welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, Tiff Stevenson, the podcast that asks if comedy can be a force for social change. On this week's show, we have Nish Kumar. Please welcome to Tiny Revolutions, Nish Kumar.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
It's nice to be clapped into a conversation.
It's how every conversation should begin. It's what we used to when we go on stage, aren't we? We're saying
Yeah. I feel too relaxed. When I hear the sound of applause, it makes me tense.
Yeah, that's good. I want you on edge for this, Nish. It's very important that you feel uncomfortable during the entire recording. Welcome to Tiny Revolutions. Tiny Revolutions is a podcast exploring whether comedy can be a force for social change. So that would be my first question, Nish Kumar. Do you believe comedy can be a force for social change?
The honest answer is I don't know. I go back and forward on it constantly. It's a question I've been asking myself a lot, probably since Brexit and Trump. Is like, can you actually use it as an engine for social change, or is it just a means by which you provide relief for people who then go on to
Make the change.
I honestly can't decide between those two things. I think that there are definitely examples of comedy that blurs the line with activism. I mean, the sort of career of someone like Mark Thomas.
I mean, Mark Watson's very much an activist.
Mark Watson's very much an activist against time. But no, I mean, the career of someone like Mark Thomas, you would say, is a kind of comedy activist role. There's certainly things that John Oliver's done in the last sort of couple of years that have directly affected policy in the States.
And it's fair to say, I think, that John Oliver's probably a big influence on you as a comic. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure, absolutely, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Thank God that guy went to America. I would literally have no career if he still lived in this country.
I think that's unfair to you.
Every day when I see him win Emmys, I'm like, do it, Oliver. Stay there. Win your Emmys. Please don't come back here.
Well, those kind of shows do affect elections in the States. With The Daily Show, definitely were a huge part of getting Obama elected, right?
I don't know. I find it hard to quantify sometimes. You know, I'm never really sure how much we actually are an engine for change, or whether we can just reflect the values of the era. I think it's a really interesting and important question for comedians to sort of ponder right now.
Is it our job?
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Is it the job of a comedian? I mean, I would say that your primary concern is to make people laugh, but at the same time, I wonder what. I mean, we're still living in the impact of Nanette and Hannah Gadsby, and I wonder whether that has whether that is another piece of comedy that will go on to change. I mean, it's certainly something that's changed comedy and reshaped comedy, but I wonder if that will play a part in kind of instigating national conversations. I mean, Chris Rock has done stand-up that's inspired genuine political and cultural debate. And I often think conversationally, when you try and reach for an idea that distills a really complicated thought down, sometimes there are pieces of comedy that distill it perfectly. You know, I was trying to talk about a sort of constant obsession of mine at the moment is Indians who voted Leave in the EU referendum.
Right.
So British Indians who, either first or second generation immigrants, who voted Leave. And you're trying to explain to people the mentality behind it. And the best way to do it is to say, do you remember that Goodness Gracious Me sketch with the two families who were called the Kapoors and the Rabindranaths, but would identify themselves as the Coopers and the Robinsons? And in the very first sketch, a Brit comes through the window that says, Packies, go home. And the four of them look at it and go, yes, quite right. And
that's not us.
No, exactly. And it's that mentality of going, like, overcompensating in your assimilation and actually weirdly contributing to your own racism. Like,
again, an erasion of your culture. And...
yeah, exactly. And again, that's an example of a piece of comedy that I often use sort of a shorthand conversation to talk about a particular political issue. But the honest answer is I would like to think that comedy can be an engine for social change. But the honest answer is I don't know if it is. And I think the best thing that we can certainly hope for is to platform conversations and also, I think, give people relief about serious and complicated issues.
Platforming conversations is really interesting because there's sort of a lot of no platforming happening at the moment. And I turned down an event recently that I was asked to do, which had Steve Bannon on at.
Mm.
And it wasn't the only reason I didn't do it, but I felt uncomfortable with Steve Bannon's views being aired. They're not fringe views. They're not his man is in power, you know. So there's all these sort of conversations. So I didn't do the event. But what I did question was whether I'd done myself a disservice, because all it meant is that The Economist didn't climb down. Their position is very much, we are free speech.
Yeah.
We give a platform to a variety of voices. And they asked me to do a sort of Me Too panel as well.
Yeah.
But the New York Times obviously did, because people like John Mulaney said...
The New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah, the New York Times, sorry. Yeah, the New Yorker. They went, we won't have Steve Bannon appear.
That did,
because people
that,
like
that did
shift Mulaney, so that did shift it. So that was a real example of where comedy kind of pushed this social change. But I don't know whether the social change is pushed in the right direction, because with The Economist, with me, I just felt like he was getting to have his voice and his say and be heard, and I wasn't.
Yeah, that's...
So essentially what I'd done is I deplatformed myself.
Yeah.
And I don't know how useful that is.
That's a real ethical dilemma, isn't it? That's a really tricky one of kind of going, if you step down and then you only leave his viewpoint, then... But at the same time, I think that you don't want to lend your name in helping to continue to legitimise people like Steve Bannon. You know, it is a difficult one. There's a lot of real quandaries being set up for us constantly.
I thought about this because I thought of you when you did Question Time.
Yeah.
With Piers Morgan. And a lot of the time when we get asked to do these sort of shows, we don't necessarily know who we're going to be on with that far ahead of time. I once did Peston.
Yeah.
And I was on with Paul Nuttall and Michael Gove.
Yeah, sure.
And I didn't know that. And that was a real lesson to me to go, find out who else is on the show. Just like both of them.
But also they don't, especially with those political talk shows, is a lot of the time, and it's not, it's not done out of malice. It's just the nature of booking politicians. A lot of the time they don't know. So like, I mean, you can't. It's really tricky one with that one. With Question Time, I found out that Piers Morgan was going to be on it when David Dimbleby announced that he and I were going to be on the first panel. And he tweeted me. He was trying to start some kind of beef.
Start the beef.
Yeah,
again,
some kind of pointless thing. But
reignite the beef.
Yeah. Well, no, that at that point, that was the ignition of the beef.
All right. Sorry. So the key wasn't in
the engine.
No, the
key wasn't in the... No, it was... But that was... But... Yeah, it is difficult because, you know, I mean, the thing with Piers Morgan is that he's a classic example of somebody who is can't stop legitimizing people. He cannot. He's so attracted to power that he can't help but legitimize people. He can't help but interview Trump. And when he interviews Trump, he does it with absolutely no journalistic rigor whatsoever. When he interviews anything that he does, the man is not a journalist. He's a kind of personality.
Yes, that's the problem, isn't it?
But I mean, I think the problem is that he claims the clout of journalistic integrity, which is why he says he's interviewing Trump, because he says he's the president of America and I'm a journalist. And you kind of look at it and you go, you're a journalist because you say you're a journalist. You have no actual journalistic integrity, and you don't function in the way that a journalist is supposed to function. You know, if you watch Good Morning Britain, he's not
neutral in the stories, is he?
He's not even just not neutral in the stories. There's no kind of intellectual heft behind anything he says.
The intellectual heft is the thing, because Piers is one of my real, is it bête noire? Was that what they call it?
Enemy. Not. Yeah, yeah.
Like, because he does these, I think they're so basic, contrarian shit takes is how I'm going to describe it on this podcast, where essentially what he does is go the opposite on an issue, what most normal, decent people would think. It's not thought through. And then it creates what I described to you before we started recording as what I'm now calling, I'm going to coin this term, panda issues.
Right.
When people take an issue and they make it black or white, like, and it's not, a lot of issues require nuance and complexity to be discussed. So someone like Piers Morgan having a go about Tess Holiday being on the front cover of Cosmopolitan and saying she's promoting obesity, where you go, no, she's a woman who's existing, who's on the front of a magazine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you want to talk about obesity, that's a separate issue that you could have a discussion about, but you don't want to have a discussion. You just want the ease of concern trolling a woman.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that's
what
you're doing. You know, we've got an obesity crisis. We've got a dickhead crisis, Piers. You're all over the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's part of the problem. So he's someone that I don't think is intellectual. I don't think he's smart, but it seems to be easier in the current climate, and it really disappoints me to put out these contrarian views or these really strongly left or right views, and any kind of nuance or reasoned debate is just gone.
Yeah, well, I think that's the nature of, that's the downside of the fact that most of our discourse takes place through social media and blogs and through the internet. That is the downside of that, you know, in 140 or 280 characters or whatever it is that you've got on Twitter now, you don't have the space to be nuanced. I think there is a huge upside to the fact that we have so much. There's been a kind of democratization of information, and the internet also, and social media particularly, give voice to communities and sections of society that otherwise we would never have heard from, because they don't have the channels open to them. I mean, like Black Lives Matter and, to be honest, the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
Both are positive examples of what media without gatekeepers can look like when it's used in a good way. You know, those are two marginalized groups who otherwise wouldn't have had the voice. Suddenly, you know, the Me Too movement, where
the power to speak up.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Which has been shared. The All Lives Matter argument is one that I always sort of compare to feminism, because they sort of go, well, why do we need Black Lives Matter? Surely all lives matter. And it's like every argument about feminism that I've ever heard, where you go, yeah, you know, men's lives matter as well.
Like, yes, equality.
But the thing is, we're not treated equally.
Yeah,
so that's exactly. We're not all treated as if our lives matter to the same degree. Mm. And that's why we need it. And we'll continue to need it until things are equal.
The very fact of the phrase Black Lives Matter is necessary language, because, you know, in America, the state treats black people as if their lives don't matter. That's what that is, you know. And Me Too, again, these are perfect. A part of the reason I think they catch on as kind of catch-all terms that a lot of these conversations happen under is Black Lives Matter is a pithy way of summarizing what's wrong with America and in this country as well. We have the same problems. And Me Too is a perfect example of what that movement meant, which is no one realized the extent to which women were just, or we weren't talking about the fact that women were being abused on this kind of scale, because no
it
one
being
was
commonplace that you're that someone, you know, a woman that you know or you are close to has experienced this to a degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the degrees are varying, and it's important that we treat them differently. But again, this is where the contrarianism comes in that's frustrating. I read a Lionel Shriver piece, and she's a brilliant author and writer, but she'd written a piece for The Spectator saying, you know, Me Too has got out of hand, and I'm not a girly girl, but I'd rather be groped and sexually harassed and abused at work than have my legs cut off or something. And I was like, you know, that's not the choices. It's is it A or B?
Yeah.
You know, like...
It's all bad.
It's all bad.
It's all bad, and it needs to be campaigned against.
I'm sure most people would rather be mugged than murdered, but that doesn't mean people should be mugged.
Yeah.
So making it this kind of... I don't know if the correct phrase is zero-sum game, but these kind of false equivalencies, that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Those aren't the choices. You're saying that we have to have that choice to just demand basic respect.
Yeah.
And then what you get with this kind of contrarianism is someone like Candace Owens. She'd done a tweet about the Kavanaugh hearings and kind of, you know, this is what radical feminists, they disgust
me.
Yeah,
sure, yeah.
They're a mob. And I made a joke of like Candace Owens is a anagram of internalized misogyny.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the pylon, and you will know about this, the social media pylon.
We were talking about this at the weekend. Yeah,
the frog, the alt-right frogs, MAGA, football jersey, eggs that hatch into full-blown trolls.
Yeah.
You know, but again, she's an example of someone who is contrarian because she knows she's going, I'm a black Republican and Republicans care about black people more than Democrats ever will. You know, and then she's comparing the Me Too movement to what happened to Emmett Till. It was absolutely insane over the weekend.
And
people like this are so damaging, and I don't know how we move forward to have this kind of ground in the middle.
Yeah, but there is, like, Candace Owens is another classic example of she's exactly the same as Indian Brexiteers, or like, I mean, and she's against feminists and the black rights movement. She's a classic example of someone who is the living result of internalized racism and internalized misogyny. And, you know, it's sometimes it's hard not to have sympathy for people like that. You know, you kind of go, do you not see that you're kind of help, you're like, you're Samuel L. in Django, you know, like that's right. Like that's where you are. You know, I don't understand why you don't see that you are digging your own grave.
And I wonder as well if there's an awareness of that, and it's because I believe she was left wing before.
Yeah.
And so I changed it when actually I don't think this is what I would call internalized misogyny so much as misogyny for pay.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So I'm coming up with these really horrible contrarian views. And I find that worse. I remember someone saying to me about Katie Hopkins once, Katie Hopkins doesn't actually think all of this. And I was like, that's worse.
Yeah.
I would rather someone who thought those things and they said it and they were honest about it and you could go to bat with them and try and get them to understand a different way of thinking than someone who's hurting the world by essentially going, I know this is dark and evil and bad, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm getting paid.
Yeah. Oh God, yeah, the sort of rent-a-gob industry is absolutely thriving. Like Candace Owens, obviously, she also knows that she's going to make money off saying stuff like that. And yeah, I sometimes worry that sometimes my fear about me and my career is that am I just contributing? Am I as bad as Katie Hopkins? That's what I think sometimes. Sometimes I worry that I am a left-wing Katie Hopkins. And like,
says about you, Nish.
Yeah, yeah. That I'm, you know, ultimately an entertainer who is financially capitalising on serious political issues. Like, that's my concern sometimes. When you look at yourself in the mirror sometimes, you have to think, like, am I profiting off the downfall of Western democracy? And sometimes you do have to ask yourself those questions. And I do sometimes worry that the kind of perfect visual representation of everything that is wrong with contemporary discourse is the fact of me and Piers Morgan appearing on Question Time together, you know? And it's like, you're two sides of the same.
The Alpha and the Omega.
Yeah, the two sides of the same problem. You're entertainers masquerading as intellects.
So, have you ever received any feedback from an audience member? And this is a question I sort of quite like asking about comedy being a force for social change. Have you ever had an email from a kid saying, seeing you made me want to start stand up, or thank you for talking about this thing. Thank you for talking about religion or culture or depression or any of those things.
Yeah, you get some really lovely messages. And especially after tour show, like I'm on tour at the moment, especially after a tour show, because, you know, you're doing sort of 80 minutes, you really try and connect with the audience, and you really have a period of time where you really feel a connection to the audience. I've had a couple of really lovely messages from trans people that have been in the audience, and I have a piece of material that is just about me. I mean, it's me attacking Ricky Gervais because I thought that his jokes about trans people were appalling and just reminded me of the sort of comedy that my parents were on the receiving end of in the 70s and 80s. Like, it seemed to me just to be, it just seems to me to be just regressive and like really weirdly old fashioned. It's like you're just kicking trans people because they're the newest group of people for you to kick, right? It's not, there's nothing. So I have a piece of material kind of attacking Ricky Gervais. And I had a couple of really nice messages from two kids who are trans who said, oh, it was just really nice to come to a comedy show and see somebody talk about trans issues and it not be, you know, it not be, aren't they weird? Like that was the message. And that's really lovely. That's a really nice thing.
And that's where you think, actually, it can, see, these are the moments that I think, oh, it can be a force for social change.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It can be a positive thing because someone felt heard, someone felt listened to, or someone even started comedy because they saw you.
Yeah.
Have you ever had an email from anyone saying, I started stand-up?
I don't think so. I mean, I imagine there are some people.
There will be.
I imagine there are some people who looked at me and was like, well, if he can do it. I mean, anyone can do
it. To use the old, if you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah.
But also,
I mean, I strongly believe that. I really strongly, but I completely believe that because I think that there's a group of us, and when I say us, I mean British or East Asian second generation immigrant comedians that only exist now because of goodness gracious me, because we were between 8, 9 and 13 when goodness gracious me first aired. Like there's Ramesh, me, Bisher, okay, Ali, Ahir Shah, there's a Tez, there's a whole bunch of us that started, that I think do comedy because of goodness gracious me. And I think if you track the age of it, you can see that we were kids. We weren't late teenagers. We were still young children. And so it's set in our minds the idea that you can be.
That's like me watching Victoria Wood.
Exactly. I was actually just about to ask you, was there someone who like
Victoria Wood and Joan Rivers, because I used to love watching Eddie Murphy and stuff, but I never really connected that a woman could do stand-up in that way till I saw Joan Rivers for the first time. I saw Joan Rivers and I was like, wow. And weirdly, Lily Savage. Seeing Paul O'Grady, I loved Lily Savage and I was like, this is really fun. Maybe I could do. But I think Joan in that real straight stand-up traditional sense.
Yeah.
Victoria Wood was the first person that made me, she kind of made me want to act more and do funny acting.
Yeah, yeah.
And do characters and stuff like that. So Victoria, I would sit down and watch with my mum. So we had, so their presence meant that I was able to do it. It's interesting that you say goodness gracious me, because I worked with Mira on a couple of things. I've worked on a couple of things with Mira. The first thing we ever did together was a big, like, it was sort of like almost like a corporate ladies' breakfast.
Yeah.
Not inspirational talks, but everyone was doing a bit of stand-up or like
right, yeah,
kind
yeah.
of TED Talk-esque.
Yeah.
And Mira did this great speech about representation. And I just think she's incredible. When we left, we got the train home together and a woman came over just sort of on the brink of tears and went, sorry, I know you're together and I know you probably don't like being bothered, but you mean everything to me.
Yeah.
Seeing you on television, that you existed, that I felt like I was represented, like literally.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was something that makes me tear up because it was so magical to watch.
Yeah.
And she was so gracious and she was so kind and she was like, well, thank you so much. And she was like, no, you know, I've watched, goodness gracious me. And there was the film as well. What was the film? The big film.
Well, there's Bend It Like Beckham in that same era.
Yeah.
And she had a novel out called Anita and Me at the time, which I remember reading.
Yeah. So this woman was just like kind of, and can I have a photo? And like I say, Mira was so gracious, but that showed me, I was like, you mean something to people. Often I'll find it if I'm out with the female comics and we're in a group, because sometimes individually you're slightly out of context. But if you're together, if there's a bunch of us, I think we went to see Catherine Ryan's show and I was with Roisin, and we walked out of the show and someone went, oh, there's Roisin and Tiffany and you're all here. And we're like, yeah, that's our friend.
Yeah, yeah.
But people were like, oh my God, we love you. We love all of you. You know, so I do feel like there's this kind of like changing tide, this kind of interesting, diverse, you know, in terms of class, in terms of gender, in terms of race, that is such a great and interesting time. And I think that there are people who are pushing back against that because they're afraid of it.
Yeah, sure.
But seeing interactions like that one with Mira.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you saying that you started stand-up because of that show.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
And I watched you at the Guilty Feminist Amnesty podcast do the... You did a Goodness
Gracious
Me sketch,
yeah, we did,
you?
Going for an English. Like, it was me, Bisha K. Ali, Sindhu V... And Himesh Patel is a brilliant actor. And Sindhu and Bisha are fantastic stand-ups and writers as well. And there was one male part that they couldn't cast. And so they got Kulvinder the Gear. Like someone said, should we just call him and ask him if he wants to play his own part? And he said yes and came up on the train for the day. And we got to do that sketch with him, which was great. It was really great.
I felt it was really magical watching that.
Yeah.
I have to say, in the audience, because seeing how much you enjoyed it and forgetting that there's great, sometimes these great sketches or bits are written and then they just kind of disappear.
Yeah, yeah.
But to seeing it recontextualized with a bunch of fresh people in it and kind of you Jimmy Falloning your way through the entire thing by
corpsing.
Yeah,
it was just too funny to me. Like it was just too...
Nish
was
couldn't
too
get
funny.
His lines out.
It was too funny to me. It was too funny to me to see him... Because the first comedy show I ever saw was them live at the Hackney Empire in 1999, and I saw them do that sketch on stage, and I just couldn't believe I was doing it in real life. It was an amazing experience. I think that it is an area where you can pinpoint comedy and culture as having a kind of social impact. I think representation does matter and is important, and that can help shift people's thinking. You know, I think that can help shift people's thinking on minority issues and help build empathy. You know, I think...
I remember seeing that for the first time and going, I'd never thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
From the point of the view of people who work in the restaurants.
Yeah.
When, like, a flood of English people come in and mispronounce the dishes and shout at them. And my friend, I think it was Neil Newbon, who was in the original playing the waiter.
Yeah.
It was Tom Tuck on the night you did it.
Yeah.
But it did. That opened up my eyes to something that I wasn't aware of. Do you have a routine where you think, oh, that might be one where I feel like I've changed some minds? Do you ever get anyone coming up at the end of your show? I had with my last two shows, with Seven and with Bombshell, I would have people come up to me afterwards kind of going, I disagree with you politically, but I really enjoyed the show. Or, oh, I think differently about that now.
I get a lot of leave voters coming up to me being like, I'm leaving, I thought it was funny. And you're like, sure.
Yeah. Yeah,
if that's
you think,
nice.
If
that's
you think
fine.
The fate of...
Well, no, it's like, I think sometimes the most I've ever had, I would say, with that is just you kind of get particularly white Leave voters kind of going, wow, I really, you know, didn't realize it was I really didn't realize it was this causing you this much anguish, and I didn't realize that we didn't know that it was going to lead to this kind of outpouring of racism. And you kind of go, there were definitely signs. There were definitely signs, and you possibly could have spotted that. But I don't know. I don't know whether that changed any of their minds. But because the end of the show that I did in 2016, so like, which I did Edinburgh and toured in the immediate aftermath of the result, the last routine in that show was a story about me getting told to go home on stage at the Comedy Store the night the results came out. So the results had been come out that morning, and I was doing the Comedy Store that night, and a guy told me to go home. So that, and this was the final routine of the whole show, and the last sort of 15 minutes.
Was that on a cutting edge, or was it just a regular weekend?
No. It would have been on the Friday night. So right. It was a Friday night, and it was very jarring, you know, and it was a very jarring experience. And I talked about that, and what you would sometimes get is afterwards people would be like, we voted Brexit, we didn't realise it was going to be, we didn't think that there'd be this much. And you kind of go, so do you now regret your decision? And they're like, no, but still, we didn't realise it was.
Just absorb it.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, the best I could hope for is that a couple of people saw it and were like, oh yeah, probably we shouldn't have aligned ourselves with that. But I think mainly what I get from shows is not the feedback I get from audience members is not, I really had my mind changed. It's more like it's a real relief to hear somebody who has the same views as us. And it is a real, it's good to see somebody is, I don't think even people find it funny anymore. I'm not sure I'm functioning as a comedian anymore, but it's more like people are like, oh, it's just good to see that there's someone as angry about this stuff as I am.
I think anger can be really funny. I mean, look at Lewis Black, for example, who, and I do think you're funny when you're angry. And I do think that means that you aren't profiting from what's going on. I feel like it's part of a kickback. I feel that it's necessary.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm pretty much exclusively preaching to the converted at this point. But I did see this year in Edinburgh, and again, Edinburgh, you're not getting that. You're not getting the mind changing.
Yeah.
Because there is a sort of, there is a liberal consensus generally in the Edinburgh Festival. But it did feel, I saw a couple of shows with women handling the Me Too movement. Because there was a lot of, you know, every year in Edinburgh, at the end of it, the journalists have to write these articles being like, oh, this year was the year of, yeah.
And mental health and dead dads. And
so it was a year where they could easily have gone, oh, okay, this year is the Me Too year. But I did see a couple of shows, without wishing to kind of reinforce that, because I don't want to encourage that sort of, you know, that slightly, like, I find that it's all a little bit too convenient to kind of reduce the entire artistic output of the Edinburgh Festival to, like, the Me Too year. And also it's slightly dismissive and, you know, patronising to the subject matter, which is obviously very serious.
The subject matter and anyone that's talked about these things before, which they will have been.
It's a weird...
Journalists just can't be bothered. They like it easy.
Yeah, completely. But I did see a couple of shows. I saw Lazy Susan's show this year, and it was a sketch show that kind of dealt head-on with the Me Too movement. And again, you're in Edinburgh, so maybe your minds are not being changed, but at the same time, it felt like being at a punk rock gig. Like it was like, there was something about it that was like energizing and really exciting to see. And also, I think also, to be honest, there's a lot of men's opinions about Me Too around, you know, there's plenty of them. Come and see my tour show for more. But there was something very thrilling about watching two women do comedy about Me Too. And it was, and also it's like sketch comedy as well, which isn't always a form, especially live hour-long sketch shows don't always lend themselves well to like a political message.
Yeah.
But God damn it, that show
really did
it. And so again, you kind of go, I even when sometimes I'm not sure whether comedy can shift the dial in terms of conversation, there was something raw and thrilling and exciting about seeing Lazy Susan's show. And also it was really silly and really funny, but really clever and had a really strong point to it. And, you know, I just wonder whether that, I can easily imagine you know, somebody, a young woman seeing that show and going, you know what, I really don't have to take any of this shit. Like, there's something kind of energizing and thrilling about being watching Freya and Celeste kind of attack thorny subject matter and just kind of go, we're going straight for it.
There is something special for women when women really love what you do, I think.
Yeah.
For me, I'm like, not that it's not for men, and lots of men do come to my shows, yeah, you know. But there is something really beautiful when another woman kind of is like, ah, oh, you know, there's a visceral level to which they connect to.
I love going and watching. I loved going and watching Rose Matafeo's show this year in Edinburgh, because there were so many young women in there. And it's only when you go to one of those shows and you go, oh yeah, I'm not normally in a gig where the majority of the audience is young women. Like, that just doesn't happen in comedy. And there is something, it's like going and seeing, you know, it's like, it's a really sort of exciting experience to be, and it's a really thrilling thing. And you feel really like, oh, this is a real privilege for me to be in this audience. And even though this, you know, this, I'm not part of this group, I'm excited to just be here and see how. I saw Get Out in a predominantly Black and Afro-Caribbean.
Yeah, I watched.
And it's like, it was exciting.
I watched, is it the Arclight in LA? I went to see Black Panther.
Yeah.
And it was magical because everyone came out and did traditional African dress. Like, for the showing of it, came out African dress, bright colours. Everyone went for it. And it felt like, oh, wow, this is a moment, because it's a moment for people of colour to have a film, which finally they go,
yeah,
here's a superhero film for
us. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
yeah, it must have been like what being a white person at the Goodness Gracious Me gig was like. Like, it is energizing to see a community and a group of people be represented. Like, representation is good for the community, but it's also, it can be a really exciting thing to be, just bear witness to and be part of.
To feel the energy around that. I think to feel the energy around people going, this is for us, finally, something for us.
It's like trying to get people to be personally accountable. And it's the hardest thing, is to try and get people to kind of go, oh yeah, some of that is me. And some of this and the way that I'm perceiving this is the fault of my conditioning. And my conditioning plays a part in that. And how do you sort of step back and unravel that? And it was really, I went to see this talk that Courtney Act was giving in Edinburgh.
Oh yeah.
So Courtney Act won Celebrity Big Brother and is, you know, a kind of really prominent drag queen in the UK.
Yes.
And there was just this long point where Courtney was talking about feeling like at one point maybe trans people wouldn't need to transition if it was more socially acceptable for them to wear women's clothing, and then having someone sit down and say, no, this is just different points in the spectrum. And you're wrong about this, and you need to think about it and understand why. And Courtney actually sat there talking about this and how the whole concept of how she saw gender completely shifted, and how suddenly she realised trans issues are completely different, as a completely different part of the spectrum from drag issues, and completely changed her mind about it. And I'm sat there listening to this thinking, this feels so unfamiliar to me. And I realised the reason it felt so unfamiliar to me was like, how often do you ever see somebody have the humility and the kind of intellectual good grace to say, hey, here's the thing that I used to think. Then I was confronted by evidence. It changed my mind. You know, it was such a powerful and bold thing to admit.
Well, I think you can get boxed into a corner, and because it's funny to have like a strong view down a line within comedy, it is quite funny sometimes to be like just on this side or this side of an issue. But I do think we punish people for changing their minds or making mistakes. And I think that's one of the big things that needs to be undone, because, you know, mistakes are progress.
Yeah,
you
sure.
learn from mistakes.
Yeah.
So the idea that you can go, I thought that, and actually I've completely changed my mind, I think is great. And that's what progressive society needs. And I'm trying to do it a bit more with myself, because I think I get myself fixed into a sort of corner on an issue, and I feel it from my gut and I get angry, and then I go, is there another way of looking at this? I'm trying to do it more, but I get what you're saying, where it feels alien. You go, how often do I do that myself?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but that's sometimes I worry with comedy, whether in order to make something funny, you have to kind of push yourself into a binary, and it's trying to make comedy that embraces nuance, and that's a real challenge. Because if you're not doing that, then maybe you are making comedy that just consolidates the status quo.
Yeah, I had a routine in Bombshell about the sort of rules of complimenting women, because that's one that comes up quite a lot,
Sure.
Of like kind of going, you can't even compliment a woman anymore. And like the bits of that is like the what people expect me to say, which is like, you know, well, you can't, and just don't be a sex pest, and don't you go, of course you still can. I think the nut of the issue is you can still compliment a woman. You can say you look lovely, but we owe you nothing.
Yeah.
And that's what you need to understand is ego and expectation.
Yeah.
You can still say the words. You can still say you look nice.
Yeah, and I think
the other thing was the caveat, if it's a shout from the top of a building or out of a moving car.
Yeah, sure.
If like
the
Doppler effect applies, then it's not a compliment.
Yeah.
But finding the subtleties in that, because as well, sometimes the issues we're discussing aren't things that can be legislated.
Yeah.
So it's easier to do a take which goes, you know, men, why don't you all just shut up and go fuck yourselves because you're really annoying
and
you pester us. Where you go, no, you're still free to pay a compliment.
Yeah.
Just don't expect anything in return. That's how that works, you know.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, just finding the
little.
I don't know why. No, because I think that is an example of it. Or
yeah,
but also getting to the beats of those things and finding where they land is really interesting in comedy, and that's why you need new material nights and stuff.
Yeah,
because sometimes you do a bit and you go, oh no, that's just wrong there. I've gone in too harsh.
Yeah,
too angry. I need to pull back.
Yeah,
I need to rephrase, or I need to repeat. Oh, Chris Rock does the old repeat.
Yeah, sure.
It's really great where he'll say,
the government hates rap. Yeah,
and he'll come back to it. He'll come back to it to remind everyone of what we're talking about.
So
I think that's what makes it beautiful and interesting. And I guess that's the difference between good comedians and bad, is finding that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I still don't have an answer for you on whether I think comedy can be. I think it can be. I think what I'm trying to say is, I think comedy can be, probably can be an engine for social change, but I'm not sure mine is. I think that's what I'm trying. I think that's what I'm getting at.
You've been listening to a Lush podcast. You can find more podcasts from us wherever you find podcasts, usually on the internet.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.